Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at electric grids and power sources today. We have a couple of guests for you. Gary Venkataramanan is an electrical and computer engineering professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison College of Engineering. John Greenler back again. John directs education and outreach at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Talking about, well, your energy-related questions, we're going to zero in on solar quite a bit. And we were looking at a title for this show, and we thought, universal electricity across the world, from solar lanterns to microgrids. So what's going on, not only here, but what's going on across the world? And Gary, in particular, has done a lot of research in this area and a lot of work in this area. So we're glad to have him along, glad to have them both along, and certainly glad to have you listening in. Questions or comments? Maybe you have solar energy powering part of your home's electricity. Love to hear about that. Maybe about energy-efficient appliances that you have in your home. You want to comment on that? 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or host on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of the page. John, welcome back.
Thank you, Larry. A pleasure to be here again.
And Gary, thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Tell us a little bit about the work that you do.
Well, we've been working in this area called microgrids for about 15 years now. They're sort of trying to see how we have, think about this grid, about this big electricity network that covers the entire country. But we talk about breaking it down into small segments and small chunks so that they're easier to control and operate, particularly when you have events related to weather problems and things like that. You don't, they don't propagate across and make the small problem bigger. So that's where this idea of microgrids come from. And more recently, we've been focusing a lot on how do we use this idea to bring power from unelectrified populations around the world or under-electrified populations around the world. And we have pilot programs that are going in India and Africa, and we do a lot of research work in the lab, developing software, hardware, all those things.
Yeah, and John, certainly the need is great across the world.
The need, you know, is tremendous. I think, you know, as you were saying in the introduction, I think we really can take our electrical power system for granted here in the United States. But in much of the world, you know, having having live electricity that you can plug into an outlet in your home or your workplace is a really big deal, and is something that can be, you know, not something that you take for granted at the beginning of the day. And so, how do we build that? How do we make it more durable? More accessible, more environmentally friendly as well, I think, all critical.
Somebody asked me, how does the electrical grid actually work? I remember playing golf in Michigan, and there were some high power lines above us, and you could hear the crackling on those lines. And you went, how does it get from one place to the next?
Well, we have all these long wires and cables. Electricity is generated somewhere. Whenever we turn the light on, a refrigerator buzzes on. There's someplace else. Coal has to be fed into a boiler, or oil has to burn in a boiler, or we have to get it from water flowing down the river from a dam. It's got to be generated somewhere, or small little solar panels or wind turbines spinning. It doesn't come for free. So wherever it's generated, we run these long wires, and it travels through them, sort of like we think about mechanical stuff. You know, we spin a wheel of a bicycle, and the chain drags the other wheel behind. Similar to that, these electrons travel around in circuits in these wires and bring power to our homes.
So how does that's really cool. But where, you know, in places, other places in the world, there are some places that don't have that kind of capability. Where have you been working?
So that's sort of been the challenge because, you know, in the United States, we sort of, like John mentioned, we take it for granted. You know, most of the electrification was done in the, after the war, before the war, during the rural electrification era, where we ran wires all around the country. And it costed a lot of resources, money, and effort, and people working together to make that happen. And that type of resources are generally not available all across the world, and all those people are not able to make the political commitment to make that happen. So we're thinking about really, really small electrical systems that may feed a few homes, a small hamlet, maybe a school or a church, and then from there the electrification access grows a little bit. In the beginning, typically in places like this, you can't even run wires. You're looking about programs where people rent flashlights or lanterns for the evening, and they bring it back, and it gets charged in the station. And so that's a sort of the bottom line. You can think about maybe renting a flashlight or renting a lantern for my home in the evening to have some lighting. The next thing that sort of more recently is going on is people have these mobile phones, and they've sort of taken over. No Pokemon Go-Go yet, but there's certainly people using cell phones all around the world, and they need them to be charged. And if you don't have electricity access, how do you charge them? So there are all these charging stations you take your phone to, and they plug it in and charge it for you for a few, a little bit of money. So that's how these programs are growing now. First comes with mobile phone access, lanterns for lighting, and then it slowly grows and people come up with new business opportunities where they can use electricity. And maybe there's some person who has enough money to say, okay, bring in, I'll get a solar panel. And maybe a larger person that says, I'll bring a generator. So it sort of grows out of that in an organic way. And in the idea of microgrids, what we're talking about is, can we integrate these together and get an ad hoc grid going and develop a business model so that you can have a, like a primitive electrification company that grows from the bottom up as opposed to top down.
That's pretty cool. So, and that's possible to do.
It is. And sort of we've established viability of that around the world. And there are prototype businesses in Africa and in India and the Far East and South America that are doing this right now. But they are sort of social entrepreneurship business models. There's a big amount of philanthropy involved. And the main question is, can we bring the cost down and scale this up? And we're slowly cutting that problem, breaking that problem down. I think within a decade or two, we'll probably be there.
Yeah. And, I think we've made my own information, from my own information or looking at it, we've made some huge gains in the productivity of solar. Have we not?
That's right. The efficiency of solar panels have gone up. The prices are going down.
Exactly. Yeah. It's you know, there's both of those variables. I mean, you can actually make very efficient solar panels, but they can be very cost prohibitive. I mean, you know, NASA, for example, has solar panels that they use on satellites that are, I think, up to 50% efficient. But you know, one could never afford that on your roof. But the point is to kind of get that sweet spot where, you know, the cost is least, you know, per watt that you're generating. And that sweet spot, that number is really rapidly dropping right now.
Let's take some calls. Thanks again for joining in with your questions or comments. You can email us at talk@WPR.org, post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, or call at 1-800-642-1234. Mike and Madison, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
A couple of things related to new technology. The molten sulfur nuclear power plant design that has the potential, apparently, to take all this waste nuclear spent fuel rods and repurpose it, I guess, and continue to utilize the energy that's still stored in that. And then also related to solar power and the storage in batteries, I've learned a few years ago that Colorado School of Mines had developed a lithium battery that charged twice as fast, stored twice as much power. I thought it would be coming out to market, but I haven't seen anything about that.
All right. The battery, is take that first, Gary, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, the batteries are becoming more effective in terms of being able to charge fast and carry a lot of energy in them without being too heavy. But there are cost barriers still present, and we really don't want to install batteries to store a lot of energy, because they are something we need to add to the investment in case if you're able to shift our loads and use electricity, mm-hmm. like they say, make hay while sun shines.
Yeah.
We sort of overcome the need for the batteries, so we want to use minimal amount of batteries. And again, in a lot of research places, they keep talking about it hits the news. Hey, we can do it 10 times faster. We can do it 3 times faster. We can always just show that what John was talking about, NASA solar cells. There's one thing to do it in a lab and show that it can be done, but another thing to make it reliable and inexpensive enough so that we can be using it every day, wherever we use on a daily basis. So there are lots of barriers to going from lab discovery to product. One of the things that on our campus that people talk about, D2P programs.
So the microgrids, would they require a battery storage?
Yes, but we were thinking about what we're working on is trying to develop microgrids with minimal amount of battery storage,
yeah.
so that we don't say, well, you need so many kilowatt hours per day, I'm going to build as many kilowatt hours of storage in there. So we want to have load management, battery management, as well as source availability, all of them coming together. The energy management and demand flexibility becomes a very, very important thing in homes or any large networks if we want to think about displacing our carbon-oriented generation into carbon-free generation.
Mm. Yeah, this whole area of what's known as demand-side technology, essentially looking at technology that allows us to balance, you know, the demand that we have for electricity, because, I mean, sometimes, you know, when you need electricity, you need it right then and there, but there are a lot of things that we do in the home or in industry where there's a lot of flexibility as to when, especially in the 24-hour cycle of the day, you know, down to, like, you know, when you run your dishwasher. If you had a smart grid technology, you know, the grid could tell you, you know, could tell your dishwasher, okay, it's 3 a.m. This is when the electricity is really available and cheap. Go ahead and run. You know, we really don't necessarily need to always hit that button at that particular point in time. And so there's a lot that's coming our way in terms of being able to balance that demand as well as, you know, how we generate that electricity.
I don't know if you guys have a comment on Mike's other words on sulfur nuclear power plants.
You know, in general, I think that, you know, right now there is a lot of discussion about nuclear and how it fits into our electrical power system, how it can potentially address climate change. You know, one area that I think is potentially very interesting that kind of fits into this to some extent is the development of nuclear power generators that are at a much smaller scale, much easier to probably to deploy, much more economical, the potential, as I understand it, to be safer, and a little bit more resilient, kind of fitting into the, you know, the concept of a microgrid. Instead of having these huge power generation systems, how can we in general, really broadly thinking beyond nuclear, how can we develop generating technology that will be more nimble to be able to meet needs, you know, where and when it's most required?
We'll take another call here. Thanks again, Mike, for calling. And we'll take that call in just a second. A reminder that we're talking today about electricity, universal electricity access across the world with our two guests today. Gary Venkataramanan is an electrical and computer engineering professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison College of Engineering. John Greenler directs education and outreach at the Wisconsin Energy Institute. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer. Oh, no, actually, Malik Anderson's our on-air producer today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. One open line for you at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. That'd be great as well. Dennis in Paloma has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. Just wondering, on average, when electricity leaves a power generating plant, what kind of volts, watts, and amps are you talking about? How much is lost? through the power lines, and how do they get it to 110 that comes into my house?
Yeah, so 110 that comes into your house is sort of safe enough for us to, we consider that we can use it for appliances at homes. When the generator plant leaves, depending on where you are, it may be from several hundred volts all the way to several thousand volts where the generation takes place. And soon after the generation takes place, the voltage gets stepped up to even higher voltages, can be hundreds of thousands of volts. There's a power plant, for instance, being shut down in Colstrip, Montana. It's one of the coal-burning plants that people have decided we don't want to run. And that run, the power from there in the middle of Montana goes to the West Coast through lines that are 500,000 volts. And the reason for going these high voltages is to reduce the power loss. You asked that question right there. Power is a product of volts and amps. You're asking how many amps and how much volts. So you multiply them two, you get power. So you get thousands of megawatts of power needs to be transferred. If you do it at a small enough voltage, you lose a lot on the way, and you'll use copper wires that are unreasonably unacceptable for us. So we step the voltage up, and so the current goes down, and we can use reasonable gauge wires for running the transmission lines. And then when it comes to close to load centers and it steps down again in several stages, goes from the transmission level voltage to sub-transmission voltage, and then gets to the substations, then you go to distribution level voltage, and then it comes down the street in the back alley of your house. At that point, the voltage may be a few thousand volts, maybe 3 kV or all the way up to 13 kV, depending on when this was installed. And then you see these spool-mounted transformers. That is where the ultimate step down that takes place then reaches your home at approximately 120, or if you're using electric heaters and stoves in your kitchen, you might be at 230 volts.
Mm-hmm. There we go.
Can I just briefly just add into that in terms of that power loss is a really critical question in terms of we think about overall efficiency. And yeah, I think it's really easy to look at those lines and go, boy, they must be really inefficient. When we look at the overall electrical power system, energy in the form of coal or whatever, it's usually like maybe 2 or 3% of the loss is actually due to transmission, as compared to maybe 40 or 50% loss, which is what happens when we actually generate that electricity. So that's really the terms of inefficiency in our electrical system, which is really significant. The vast majority of that is actually at the point of the generation. And most of that lost energy is in the form of heat.
Scott in Kewaunee, your turn now. Thanks for waiting, Scott. Hi.
Good morning. Hey, I had a question for your guest. About 6, 7, 8 years ago, I'd say it was, on TV on 60 Minutes or 2020, one of those shows, they featured a segment where this fellow produced these plates about the size of your hand, and you would stack them on top of each other and feed propane or natural gas into this system. And for every $100 worth of gas you put into it, you'd get $300 worth of electricity. And he would like everybody to have one of these units, which would have been about the size of a refrigerator that you'd put behind your house, and you could produce your own electricity. Whatever happened to that...
Invention or what have you. Gary, do you know anything?
Scott refers to the technology of fuel cells, and there are continuing work going on, and fuel cells are practical, and they'll be using at fairly large power levels. But the power levels where we want to put a refrigerator-sized unit at our home, that still remains a dream for us. There are several companies around the country that are continuing to work on that can take natural gas and generate electricity. And also at the same time, they will also, their emission will be a little bit of carbon dioxide because you're burning natural gas or propane, but you also get water in the exhaust. And it's hot water, which you can use for your home. So it's sort of like a two-in-one type of deal. But a lot of the research in there, this is one case where going from laboratory to a product to get the high levels of reliability. And in this particular case, there is a platinum catalyst that's involved in the fuel cells, making it effective. And that some of those advances that people have projected have failed to happen. But there has been other, there's been spin-offs from that that are leading to many other developments. So we wouldn't say that it's sort of dead. There's a lot of opportunities that are growing out of that. People are looking at biofuels, look at fuel cells. Maybe John may have a couple of things to add to this.
Well, the other thing that was coming to my mind, actually, is the potential to, if we do need to use fossil fuels to generate electricity, there are a lot of advantages to doing it locally in a microgrid-type fashion. So, for example, you know, if we are going to use natural gas to generate electricity using a generator-type system, frequently heat, whether it's hot air or whether it's water, is a resource, is a byproduct. And if we generate that locally, that can actually be utilized in that building. And so, as I was mentioning earlier, that inefficiency of generation, if you're doing that generation 50 miles outside of a city, you essentially need to throw all that heat away. But on the other hand, if you're doing it in the building where you're going to be using that electricity, you can use that then. That heat and then drive your efficiency levels up
way up.
You know, you can go from 40 to 50% efficiency to 80 to 90% efficiency in terms of energy in versus energy out. And this is a big opportunity in terms of microgrid to really up our efficiency, and the ramifications for that in terms of the fuel sources we're using, and also in terms of the greenhouse gas emissions, really being able to drive those down by just being much more efficient is a real key one for microgrids and similar.
Scott, thanks again for calling. I want to give Mary in Pewaukee a chance to join us next. Mary, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for the opportunity.
Sure.
Hi, Larry and guests. My husband and I have a home, kind of middle class type home here, and we're curious as to how to go more green. So what would basically our first step be, and where do we look? How do we find out? Do we use NARI, NARI, do we do solar generator? And then secondly, after that, I know that's kind of long, is there still a tax break from the government for people that do go more on off the grid? And how long before you would actually save enough money to save more than you spent?
Yeah.
So the first step would probably to do an energy audit for your home.
Mm-hmm.
And there are several agencies that will do an audit for your home, looking at electricity use, natural gas use, your windows and all those things, and recommend something that is most suitable for you to do. And then as a part of this energy audit process, you can also get connected with some of the photovoltaic installers who can come to your home, take a survey, or even you can give them the address. They can use Google Maps to figure out what the potential is, and then they'll do a little survey, how your roofs are, how many trees you have around your house. And Larry was talking about doing similar assessment for his home few years ago, perhaps. But that can be done. And then after that, you think about hiring them to do that for you, and they will come and install the solar panels on your roof after they inspect your roof and figure out if the roof is suitable for carrying the extra load. Otherwise, you may need to do some reinforcement. But the thing that one thing you added on to this is their incentive for going off-grid. You probably don't want to go off-grid, because in that case, you won't have any electricity at night unless you install a lot of storage. So if you be connected to the grid in the meanwhile, you supply your excess electricity, what you don't use during the day, to the grid for other people to use, and then you use the electricity at night from the grid. So that sort of grid-connected solar is the most economic way of doing this. And obviously there are tax incentives for this, and until I think year 2019, there's the amount of money you spend towards this, if it follows certain norms regarding efficiency, et cetera, you're able to get a tax break at the end of the year up to 30% or so. So in case your system is going to cost $10,000, at the end of the year, you'll get a tax reduction of 30% of that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the numbers that I'm hearing right now, and there's a lot of variation depending upon your site and where you are, or what, you know, what your electricity costs off the grid. But I think, frequently, the, you know, the payback period these days is somewhere around 5 years. I think it's a good general number. The other thing, and maybe at some point we can do a whole separate show on this, but an interesting opportunity that's really coming down the pike is what's known as community solar. So if you don't personally have a good site for panels on your roof or whatever, you kind of think about the community garden type model that you know, you would basically be sharing a larger scale solar installation somewhere, you know, in, you know, in your general area, buying in with a number of individuals to essentially have your own community solar garden of sorts. And so, because, yeah, I think, you know, many people really have a site which is suboptimal. So it's definitely worth looking at, but we're gaining a lot of alternatives there if you don't have that well sunlit roof, for example.
And the energy... I'm trying to remember the name of the organization, the Wisconsin
Focus
on Energy. Mm-hmm. Why? How could I forget that? Focus on Energy is the place I highly would recommend you to go, because there, all of the things that Gary and John have been talking about are right there on the Focus on Energy website.
Right. It's a great program that we have in the state, and yeah, we need to continue to make sure that they get supported.
Yeah, absolutely. Good luck. Thanks, Mary, for calling. Bernie in Burlington, your turn. Hi.
Yes, thank you very much. I've been waiting for a program for this type of knowledge for a long time. I've got a Hutton Camp, so they call it, in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. It's way off the grid. And I have 160 watts of solar there for the last 10 years or more. For the lights and radio and TV and that sort of thing.
Sure.
But what I need, life or death, is a refrigeration system that only would work in the summertime. That's when I'm there, where I could keep some kind of a solid-state refrigerator, put some ice in there for a ballast to keep it cool at night and during the day. Sunshine's fantastic up there. And how would I go about getting this, and how much would it cost, and who do I call?
All right.
So you probably have a small DC system for a few lamps and a few refrigerator for TV and radio.
Yes.
So there are DC refrigerators available in the market today, and they are quite efficient. And they will also be able to size it. You're thinking about an apartment style, a small unit that you can keep a couple of six packs, opposed to a full fledged kitchen with a freezer and everything.
Absolutely.
You would certainly be able to add something like that. You may be able to get a small enough panel. You may have to double your panel capacity because moving heat and keeping things cool, surprisingly, is a lot more difficult compared to having a light on or having a radio playing. Because you may have felt that when you drive a car and as you turn on the air conditioner, how much the engine struggles. So moving heat is not an easy problem. But so you may have to double your solar panel
That's
capacity.
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
There you go.
And you know, as we were talking about earlier in the show, you know, the price for battery storage is going down, and that might be something that you would want to consider to put into that system. You know, the amazing, you know, like Elon Musk's Tesla Powerwall. You know, there's some technology, even just you know, that's tried and true technology that's really coming down in price. Might be a good addition
to look into. Yeah, for sure.
There are also natural gas refrigerators, propane powered refrigerators you can get that you can run from a tank.
I used to have that till our old cabin burned down, took the refrigerator in with it.
So sorry.
That's too bad.
Well, Bernie, hopefully this has been helpful. Thank you so much for calling today.
Appreciate you. Thank you.
Thank you for calling. Tony from Oshkosh emailed to ask a question regarding microgrids. The U.S. grid is mostly alternating current because alternating current is easy to be sent over long distances. Do microgrids still use alternating current, or can they operate effectively on direct current, and is there a benefit to doing so?
Yes. So there depends on the size. The previous the caller who talked about a small cabin up north. So if you're thinking about a small home with a few tens of watts of power inside the home, it's more effective to run a DC these days because there's a lot of these LED lamps that are coming in. Many of them newer electronic equipment like televisions and laptop computers, all those devices operate on DC. And the solar, obviously, is generating DC, so it makes sense to have a small enough DC system to prevent, to reduce, to keep the systems more efficient. On the other hand, if you go from house to house, if you're starting putting a network together, there are issues related to safety. AC has been shown to be a lot safer than DC when you're looking at overhead open lines with trees falling over and potential for hazardous situations. So people tend to want to prefer AC when you go outside a home, or when the power level reaches a certain level, you have the capacity to turn, step it up and step it down as necessary to keep the losses down. So I would say if your power needs are greater than a few hundred watts, we'll go into a AC microgrid. And obviously you can run a DC micro, a hybrid system that uses DC inside for some of the lower power items. Mm-hmm. And then you say, well, I want to put a refrigerator, I want to put an air conditioner, and then you sort of slowly move up the ladder as your needs grow up, and then you can have an AC system, and then you bring power lines from outside as reinforcement. And this is type of the migration pathway we're looking at for, particularly for remote applications in developing nations, having DC and AC systems together, and also be able to work with the legacy system and also keep up with what may happen in the future.
Talk about some of the examples of places already using microgrids. You sort of in general talked about it, but give us a little more on that.
So in some of the places in Tanzania where John was talking about, there's a firm called Off Grid Electric, and they've been very successful in installing. There are thousands of villages now that are being supplied by off-grid systems. Mm-hmm. They're DC systems or hybrid systems. And large companies that we know, like Microsoft and Caterpillar, mm-hmm. And Google, they all have investments in smaller companies that are doing business development in these locations. They're in Kenya, they're in Ethiopia, they're in Uganda, and we have some of our students who are starting writing business plan competitions and have venture capital funding to develop these opportunities. And they're all over the world, but they're sort of invisible below the radar because they're not at the point that they're making money yet.
Okay.
But, you know, there's some classic examples even here in the United States. So, for example, in New York City during Hurricane Sandy, there actually was, a very large housing co-op building that actually had its own internal microgrid with, a system down in the basement. And during the hurricane, during the superstorm, Manhattan lost its power. And there are these classic images of, Manhattan being dark. And then, boom, there's this one building where all the lights are on. It's another example of the opportunity of a microgrid is that kind of that durability, that reliability of having mm-hmm. some redundancy in the system is really a value.
Pretty cool. Paul and Slinger, thanks for calling. Hello.
Hi, guys. Multifaceted question. Apparently the United States, from ocean to ocean, is a macro grid except for Texas. My question is, is there software operating where the link, so each one of the power companies have a defined geographic area. Do they exchange and share energy moving across the high voltage transmission lines? And is it metered? For example, if I'm in Wisconsin Public Service and then we have We Energies, and We Energies needs power in a large industrial area. Does the software analyze the energy being produced by their generation stations versus what they could purchase from Wisconsin Public Service and determine that they can purchase it at a lesser cost per kilowatt from them, including line loss. Does such software exist where it's totally standalone software that can do this instantaneous analysis? And so each month the power companies invoice each other for the energy that's been transferred.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So the U.S. grid is divided into three segments, the eastern United States, western United States, and there's, of course, Texas. But all of them can exchange energy on a real-time basis all the time. And there are revenue-settling mechanisms between different operating utilities, and there are system operators all around the country in several locations that are managing the power flow. And if you say there's an automatic software that takes care of that, there are many energy trading entities in the country, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and the National Energy Reliability Council. They all develop lots of rules on how these markets operate. There are day-ahead markets, there are month-ahead markets, and there are also 30-minute markets, and they're very short-term regulation
wow.
reserves. There are marginal prices, short-term marginal prices. The electricity energy market is a interesting case study in itself. The idea of microgrids, what we're talking about, is something that will overlay on this market to get the system more efficient so we can have a bottom-up process that sits on the top-down process that exists together. They can meet both ways. Essentially, the overall goal is to bring the bring levels of energy efficiency up, and also be able to integrate non-disposable, non-dispatchable electricity generation sources like wind and solar to be integrable with the main grid.
Very, very cool. We're about out of time, and Pam had wondered about the laws protecting solar access. If you install something and somebody builds a great big building that overcomes your building, or they plant a tree that gets and blocks your solar, are there laws on that yet?
I am not aware of any laws like that. I mean, it has to be worked on a bilateral basis. And, you get a nice lake view, and all of a sudden there's another building that came in front of your property,
yeah.
and you lost your lake view. What are you going to do? I'm not sure. I think these things might become important as we move into the future.
Well, it's been a real pleasure talking with you both today. And Gary, I hope you'll come back and be with us again. It was really enjoyable. Thank you so much. And John, always a pleasure. You're going to be back in a month or two, and we'll do this all over again.
Yes, please. Thank
you. On different topics. Thank you so much. Great to have with us our two guests today. Gary Venkataraminan is an electrical and computer engineer at the University of Wisconsin-Madison College of Engineering. John Greenler directs education and outreach at the GLBRC and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. And we'll have him back, and we'll do this again. It was really interesting for me. And always interesting for me is the weather and climate. And since it's the last Monday of the month, it's time for our weather guys next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.